When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go to suburbia.
We don't want an urban environment. We don't want to feel like downtown. Define for us suburban urban environment.
Suburban urban is not exactly the inspiration for a song lyric, but sprawly suburbs are looking to get some there in their nowhere. Even though urban planners have trouble saying the word, we know what they mean. The lights are much brighter there on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, June 12th, our series on rethinking the future of where Americans live continues with the suburbs this morning. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai today. Good morning, Farai.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, Iran's election is going into overtime. We'll have voices from inside Iran and analysis of what comes next. Plus, it's Hollywood's way of going green, recycling an old action plot about public transit. We'll take a look at the remake of The Taking of Pelham 123 and what it says about post-9/11 New York. All this and more ahead, but first we've got your latest headlines.
And in the headlines, we start with Iran, where they're extending voting time amid reports of high turnout. Hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's strongest challenger is the reform-minded Mir Hussein Mousavi. There's no exit polling, so full results unexpected for a day or so. We want to welcome anyone listening to us on the radio in case their TV doesn't work this morning. More than a million Americans lose the ability to pick up free over-the-air television today, the last day for analog broadcast signals. In the simplest terms, it means if you don't have cable or a new digital TV, you need a special converter box to pick up local stations. The FCC can help you with that. Operators are standing by, right?
And the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington reopens today. It's been an incredibly hot topic that we've covered here on our show. Wednesday's shooting killed a museum guard, left the suspect critically wounded. The suspect, James Von Brunn, is charged with first-degree murder. In Texas, there are strong thunderstorms that have produced flooding, power outages, canceled flights, widespread damage. The storm system is pounding the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it's not over yet. And an African court says that Madonna can adopt a second child from Malawi. A high court there ruled in her favor earlier today.
A bill giving the Food and Drug Administration broad power over tobacco should be ready for the president to sign soon. It cleared the Senate yesterday by a wide margin. The House is expected to pass it today.
Now, another chunk of General Motors is reportedly close to being sold in Sweden. Sweden-based Saab says a deal is close, but it's not naming the buyer. Scandinavian investors making the deal. Official announcement could come as early as today.
Who's going to buy Mr. Goodwrench? In sports, the LA Lakers now have a 3-1 lead over the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals. They won last night in overtime. Hockey crowns a new champion tonight. The Pittsburgh Penguins visit the Detroit Red Wings in a Game 7. The winner will hoist the Stanley Cup. The S&P and the Dow posted modest gains yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 944. The Dow kicks off at 8770. So continuing our series of waiting for the train, waiting for new infrastructure, imagining different kinds of communities in a new era. We're talking about Denver, Colorado, but we're thinking about the suburbs today. What do you think of the suburbs? Lots of dark images of the suburbs in pop culture. What do you think? Are the suburbs fond memories for you or something of a nightmare? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea. It's election day in Iran. It's been an election like none other in 3 decades since the revolution. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is facing a serious challenge from Mir Hossein Mousavi, a moderate former prime minister. Many in Iran would like to see Ahmadinejad gone. The economy is in serious trouble. Unemployment is at 17%, inflation over 23%. Many of Mousavi's supporters would like to see greater social freedoms, especially for women. And here to take a look at the election, we have Afshin Moulavi, a senior fellow at New America Foundation, author of Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom. Good morning, Afshin.
Good morning to you.
Let's start with the question of what's at stake here. We certainly in the United States talk about Iran a lot in the context of geopolitics, but what is going on the ground right now as people are making their decisions?
Well, I think what is so striking is that, you know, we often, as you say, talk about Iran in terms of geopolitics. And when we think of Iran, we think of uranium enrichment and its nuclear program, or Iran's activities in Iraq, its support for Hezbollah or Hamas. But on the ground in Iran, Iranian voters are more interested in kind of bread and butter issues, the state of the economy, as you said, social freedoms, political freedoms. And this has been an extraordinary election, and mostly because we've had live televised debates in Iran for the very first time. And these have been more smackdown than debate. The candidates have been hurling insults at each other. You know, the general line against Ahmadinejad by his opponents has been that he has mismanaged the economy. He has further isolated Iran with his reckless rhetoric, including Holocaust denial. And essentially made Iran into an international pariah. Ahmadinejad, on the other hand, has effectively counterpunched, pointing to his opponents as members of a corrupt ruling elite. He tries to present himself as kind of a populist man of the people who is interested in the poor and the working classes. And Ahmadinejad's accusations, no matter who wins this election, will poison the air of Iranian politics for some time to come, even after these elections are over. Because essentially what he has been saying is that there is a corrupt ruling business elite in the Islamic Republic. There is an Islamic Republic of Iran, Inc. And so these elections have exposed serious rifts within the ruling leadership, but they've also excited the public like no other election before.
Well, Afshin Malabi, it seems to me that what's really interesting about both of those claims, both about Ahmadinejad and this, you know, this opposition leader who actually goes way, way back in Iranian politics, which is an irony in and of itself, is that these elections are really about a fairly enormous passing of a torch, a generational torch that we haven't seen since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution back in the late 1970s. Is that what's at stake here in this election, do you think, or am I overplaying it?
No, I think you make an important point, John. In many ways, Ahmadinejad represents a second generation of Iran's revolutionary elite. And this generation cut their political teeth not against the fight to overthrow the Shah, but in the war with Iraq. And that generation, which is in positions of power in many parts of Iran right now, spring from the intelligence services, security services, and most notably the Revolutionary Guard.
But let me ask you something about that. Yeah. Why hasn't the carnage and what I would think to be an enormous stain on the Iranian leadership for the Iran-Iraq war with all of the people that died, why hasn't that stuck to Mousavi?
I think in many ways Mousavi was seen as a strong candidate by the reform camp because he has spoken about, you know, reform ideas of late. But more importantly, he has impeccable war credentials, Iran-Iraq war credentials, because he was the prime minister of Iran during that very troubling and dark moment in Iran's history, and he was seen as someone who managed the economy well at that very difficult time. So in many ways, one of the reasons he is the candidate and the favored candidate of some of the top reform political elite is because of his Iran-Iraq war background.
Interesting.
When we spoke with one of our colleagues at the BBC, he was saying that he had never seen so many people in the streets, since in decades for an election. Give me a sense of the feel that people have been having about their political participation, their willingness to take risks to be in the public square in order to express their desire for leadership. What's going on there?
No, I think that's right, Farai. And I think, you know, Iranian politics has always had a street element, which has been always lively and animated and colorful. You remember the images of the millions pouring out to greet Ayatollah Khomeini when he returned from exile after the revolution was successful in 1979. People are comparing the street scenes right now to the kind of street scenes that they were seeing in 1979.
Do you buy those comparisons?
You know, I buy the comparisons of the numbers. I don't think we're in a pre-revolutionary situation, though, right now in Iran. The Islamic Republic elite still has strong control over the country.
What about culturally? If you think about this nation where the majority of people are, you know, well under what Americans would consider middle-aged, you know, well under 40, what kind of cultural power do youths have today, you know, people who are of voting age but who are still young? What are they looking for in terms of a relationship to the West, not just as a political entity or series of entities, but culturally?
You know, when I traveled across Iran, you know, to more than 20 different cities and villages and spoke with a lot of young people, one of the things I found was how normal their demands were. And in fact, one young person said to me, look, all I'm asking for is a normal life, an opportunity for a decent job, an opportunity to get married, to have some levels of social freedoms and some marginal levels of political freedoms. They weren't really asking for much. But one of the interesting things I found about this generation of young people compared to their parents' generation of 1979 is that this generation of young people are very pragmatic in their concerns. They do not buy the kind of leftist utopianist ideas of their parents' generation, and so this desire for normalcy seems to be something that one hears over and over again.
You know, we often associate Iran with the Middle East, rightly. Of course, it's not an Arab nation. It's a, you know, Persian nation. They speak Farsi there. But I'm wondering if the model for Iran, specifically on these pragmatic issues, is to the east in India, where they've had such success economically. Does Iran think that it can duplicate that?
I think, interestingly, as you know, you mentioned Iran is Persian. It's not Arab. There is this a certain amount of Persian pride, even going into arrogance. So when Iranians like to think of themselves and like to look at models, they like to compare themselves to Europe and or the West. And I think among Islamic Republic elites, however, the model that they look to is China, particularly among the conservative elites, because they see a place where the commanding heights of political power are in strong control, but they've managed to achieve economic growth and to trade pluralism for consumerism.
Afshin, I'm going to break in because we have a voter with us. Reza Shagai, you are in Tehran, and what is the state of play with the election? What are you seeing on the streets, and have you voted?
To be honest with you, this morning I went for just participating in this election, but unfortunately I saw a lot of people, they're willing to participate, and I saw a lot of long queues, and it took for the people a long time to just standing in these queues. So I got my car, I just changed my location. I went to different places, and I saw the same situation anywhere. I think all the people are willing to just change these circumstances. My expectation is they are trying to just select one of the reformist candidates, I think. Since I'm a fan of Mr. Mousavi, I think they are planning to just select this one to just try to change these circumstances.
Can we ask, who are you voting for?
Mr. Mousavi.
Why? What does he represent to you?
To be honest with you, even though I don't believe 100% to this candidate, but nevertheless, I'm sure he wouldn't be as hardline as Mr. Ahmadinejad, and he is planning to just change the circumstances of Iran in the relation with the United States.
That is one vote for Mousavi from Reza Shagai in Tehran. Reza, we thank you so much for that. Also, thanks to Afshin Molavi, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of The Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom. And John, you've spent a lot of time around the region.
Well, I mean, I think what's interesting about what's going on in Iran is you see the emergence of what you would see if you spent time in Iran, and that is the volubility and the demonstrativeness of the Iranian people. They really do have opinions, strong opinions. There's a lot of local politics in Iran, and it's really emerging, and you see it in all of the pictures on this very historic election.
Thanks, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
That's what we're doing all week, waiting for the train, like Jimi Hendrix. It's a metaphor for American communities waiting for possibly radical new infrastructure like light rail systems, mixed-use residential developments to take advantage of new live-work technologies. Our laboratory this week is Denver, Colorado, where a group of urban planners and architects is gathering to debate some tough questions about how Americans live. Today, look at the suburbs, where the job is particularly challenging, especially in the Denver area. Our friend Ellen Dunham-Jones is the director of the architecture program at Georgia Institute of Technology and co-author of Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redesigning Suburbs. She's in Denver with the New Urbanists this week and thinks the city may have a lot to teach us about how suburbia and downtown might actually have a closer relationship.
Denver is doing a lot of really great things, in fact, and most significantly, back in 2004, the voters approved one of the largest light rail and bus rapid transit packages in the country, and they are extending transit out into the suburbs.
Now, how is that going to change the lives of people who are used to getting on the highway and increasingly sitting in traffic for hours at a time?
It's certainly going to give them a lot more options. And what we're seeing is a lot of people are really interested in that. We're seeing them spending more time doing all of the great things you can do in Denver, like get out into nature, because they're not spending so much time stuck in traffic.
But if rail connects suburbs to each other, there's less of a need for parking lots. There's probably less of a need for all of these strip malls and big box shopping centers. What do you do with those kinds of facility and those kinds of facilities and all that acreage?
Well, we've been tracking around the country, seeing what developers like to refer to as underperforming asphalt, just like the examples you described. There is increasingly a desire for more and more people to live closer in. We've seen gas prices spike, and they're probably going to continue to go up again. And more people want to live in a suburban location where their jobs are, where their kids' schools are, but they want to live a more urban lifestyle. And so redevelopment of these former surface parking lots sites into more urban, multi-story, mixed-use places is happening all over the country, and especially in Denver.
Now, I've seen some retrofitting, which looks a little bit scary in some communities around the country, where you have something that used to be maybe a Penny's turned into something that's maybe more like a Goodwill flea market. But you're talking about something much more specific called smart growth, which urbanizes suburbs and makes them more centralized with all kinds of services. How do you do that, and how do you make those communities attractive?
Well, we've seen so many different examples of how people do it. Certainly, one of the real keys to getting increased density is getting a mix of uses so that people don't have to get out in their cars. I mean, suburbia has been planned very much on your single-family housing is over here of one-acre lots, your two-acre lots are over there, your shopping is in another place. And when we start to redevelop dead malls, dead office parks into mixed-use places, we start to see about 25, sometimes even as much as 45% of the trips that those people take are now walking or on transit or on bike. They're staying in their neighborhoods. And if they can get transit, then we're seeing even more of those trips, people not getting in cars.
Ethnically and demographically, and I guess in terms of income, et cetera, who's moving to communities like this?
We're seeing a huge change in suburban demographics. The boomers are interested in, a lot of them, as they retire, they want to stay in the same community, but they want to be in more inclusive environments where they can walk to things, get engaged in a lot of activities. And they're very interested in more urban places, as are the young professionals who increasingly are finding that their jobs are in suburbia, but they want some nightlife. They want some action. They really aren't looking for a single-family home quite yet.
What community does this smart growth strategy really well, and what are some examples?
Well, D.C. has done a great job of extending their metro rail system out into the suburbs, and whether it's projects like Rockville Town Center, University Town Center, Twinbrook Commons, there's a whole lot of projects in D.C. that one can look at. And Denver is following suit in many respects with projects like Del Mar and Englewood. Denver, more than half of its malls have been or have announced plans to retrofit and become more urban.
Is the driver of this development public money or private money? Does the public money have to precede the private? How does it work?
It's always a partnership, but there are very different ways. Sometimes the owner of a property themselves wants to go in and seize the opportunity for greater density on the site. Transit coming to an area often triggers private property owners to get involved. But other times, the city is often left owning a dead mall after the original owners have defaulted on taxes. And so sometimes it's public-led as well.
So how's this go viral? Is it a word-of-mouth kind of thing where people see communities that they like and want them replicated? Or is it a group of political leaders that's going to really create the momentum to move forward on things like transit and the infrastructure to make these communities possible? And do you see those leaders out there?
I think certainly the Congress for the New Urbanism has been a great think tank at advancing a lot of these ideas. But it's also true that people have been going to these places. And sometimes, I mean, a lot of the retrofits, people do still drive to them to then get an idea of what it's like. But then they begin to imagine, gee, I actually would like to live in a place like this. I watched my own dad, who's always been a Mr. I want the big home, the big car, and the big on the big lot, came to visit me at one point down at a new urbanist village called Seaside in Florida. And suddenly my dad thought, wow, this is such a great place.
Wow. Right?
And he would never have considered it without just visiting.
Well, as usual, it is fascinating and really exciting to imagine the future with you once again. Ellen Dunham-Jones, she's the director of the architecture program at Georgia Tech and co-author of the book Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redesigning the Suburbs. So new urbanists have a future, huh?
I think so.
Thanks, Ellen.
There's a headline. Femi Okeh has some more.
Thank you very much. It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. Poll times have been extended for 2 hours in Iran today due to heavy turnout in the country's presidential election. Voters are deciding whether to keep President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in power for another 4 years. In Sudan, the government is allowing 4 expelled aid organizations to come back. The East African country expelled 13 of the largest international aid groups in March after the International Criminal Court indicted Sudan's president for war crimes in its Darfur region. The controversial trial of a pro-democracy leader is on hold in Myanmar. The Asian nation is also known as Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi's trial is adjourned for 2 weeks, and this will allow her lawyers to call a new witness who will testify in the case against her and will say that it is politically motivated. And that's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Where do you find yourself? continuing now with our series exploring new urban environments all over America. First of all, we're asking you, do you think of suburban America as a dream or something of a nightmare?
My name is Mario Torres. I'm from Columbia, Maryland, but I'm a native New Yorker. I do live in the suburbs right now, but I can tell you I really don't like it. And I always go back home to New York City for the diversity, the differences in buildings. And I am all for redesigning suburbia to make it more pedestrian-friendly, much more visually interesting than the cookie-cutter environment that it has engendered since World War II.
Your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Joining us now is our own new urbanism explorer himself, transportation writer Matt Dellinger, who is in Denver, Colorado, for the Congress of New Urbanists that we've been talking about. Matt, you're in a position now to see firsthand how challenged or enthusiastic some of these Denver suburbs are about making the changes we've been talking about, especially a new rail system. So what have you seen?
Well, yesterday we went on a tour, which basically we just rode the light rail line, the Southeast F line, to a couple of places out in the suburbs where they are building new village-style projects along the light rail system. And, you know, it's a little hard. The municipalities out there, the governments are trying to make sense of the change. Of the, you know, there's suddenly a light rail station, and there's also a highway. They upgraded the highway to 10 lanes at the same time they built the interstate.
So which is strange.
Some of it was a little bizarre, a little schizophrenic out there.
Besides having a highway next to a rail system, what else was bizarre about it?
Well, we went to a place called Greenwood Village.
Right.
And a guy named George Weaver there, who's the director of community development, he described the challenges in forging an identity for this development.
Greenwood Village is really struggling with the notion of going from a suburban office environment to creating a, not an urban, because clearly the city council said, we don't want an urban environment. We don't want to feel like downtown. Define for us suburban urban environment.
So, Matt, does this mean they're looking for a coherent center of town, but they don't want to call it downtown?
Kind of, but, you know, coherent would be a generous word to use. When we arrived at Greenwood Village, we're in a streetcar, which we'd been riding along I-25 the entire way. And the first thing you see off to a left, to the left, is a huge parking garage with a clock tower on it, which it's kind of is a physical manifestation of this schizophrenia I was talking about. And
it's a little medieval, too, I suppose.
I guess it's trying to be anyway. Yeah. And George Weaver was describing there's a lot of little things they're doing to try to make this feel like a city or a village or a town. And George Weaver was describing a fountain that they're going to put right there on the site.
It'll have lights, it's programmable, and it's intended to provide a lot of white noise. As you come off the train, you noticed how noisy it was. The white noise from this fountain, it's going to be a gusher and a gurgler. It's going to try and make the retail space down on that plaza level a little bit more pleasant than what it would otherwise be.
So a musical fountain as a kind of mini Times Square. Are other villages taking maybe some other examples of trying to get a downtown or a downtownish feel?
They are. In fact, there's the light rail will eventually be extended even farther, three more stops in the next 10 years. And there's a place out there called Ridgegate, which, in fact, is hoping to become an edge city. And they talked about building a downtown that would look like downtown Denver, tall buildings and a real, real urban environment. They're kind of, you know, swinging for the fences there.
Now, you know, in general, there are people that you're collaborating with there thinking about communities like Denver and all the challenges. We talked with Ellen Dunham Jones, who's out there as well making presentations. Are the new urbanists feeling like Denver has it right here, is going down a road that's going to actually get somewhere?
Well, they know that they're trying, and they see that they're trying. And in some cases, they're succeeding. I did talk to a guy named Sam Zimbabwe, who's a transportation expert. He was on the tour with me. He's with Reconnecting America. And he feels like the places we saw are sort of watered-down versions of what they'd want.
I probably would not call what we saw today new urbanism. And I don't think that I heard too many of the developers actually pitching their product as new urbanists. I was actually interested to hear that they were trying to, in many cases, preserve some of the suburban values as they were building more density. And so I think what we saw was more of a better suburbanism.
You know, this is some of the criticism of new urbanism. I want to throw it to you directly. I mean, is it are new urbanists out of touch with reality in terms of the compromises and the realities that are going to be making some of these changes, and that there are always going to be compromises and we're always going to get somewhere that's not utopian, that's more in the middle?
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, for a new urbanist, taking them to your new village transit center is like taking a New Yorker to your favorite bagel shop in Cleveland. They're never going to be happy. There's always going to be something wrong. But there's a smell test. You know when you're in an urban place, because it's not just that you can technically get from the train to the office building you're going to, but maybe you pass some shops on the way. Maybe you see other people. Maybe those people are, doing unorganized things like begging for change.
Well, you make a great point. The users are going to define the identities of these new communities. The architecture is really just the beginning. We're going to be talking with James Howard Kunstler, another new urbanist, later on in the morning. Matt Dellinger, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Matt Dellinger, of course, our new urbanist, prowling Denver for signs of change. And it's time now for Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. President Obama is firing the Inspector General who investigates AmeriCorps and other national service programs. This news comes after the U.S. attorney in Sacramento criticized the IG for his investigation into the city's mayor. More than 1 million Americans aren't ready for television's digital conversion today. When TV stations upgrade their analog signals to digital, some households won't get television service unless they also upgrade their TVs for digital TV as well. Bill Lake is the digital TV coordinator for the Federal Communications Commission. He says that even people with newer sets may need to make adjustments.
It's going to be very important to rescan for signals, because there will be a number of stations which will move their signals from one frequency to another in connection with the transition, and others which have been broadcasting at lower power and will increase their power after the transitions.
The shutdown of analog channels will free up the airways for things like wireless and broadband. In international news, Iranians are streaming into the polls today in a close presidential election. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is facing a strong challenge from the former Prime Minister Mir Hossein Mousavi. Right now, Iran's phone text messaging system is down, and this is a problem because Iranians use text messages to quickly spread election information. The final election results will be out in a couple of days. And finally, the New York Times is reporting today that the U.S. officials say that there is evidence that dozens of al-Qaeda fighters, are moving from Pakistan to Somalia and Yemen. Intelligence officials say that they've been noticing a spike in communication.
Thanks so much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Now we're going to go to Australia, where Indian students have vowed to fight back against racists they've blamed for a series of callous attacks. There have been demonstrators rallying in Sydney and Melbourne, where dozens of assaults against Indian students have been reported in the past year. We're going to talk to Gautam Gupta, who was himself attacked. He says the authorities have been too slow to respond, so he set up something called the Federation of Indian Students of Australia to protect Indian students. Now, Gautam, take me to your attack. Just tell me a little bit about the circumstance, where you were, and what you think happened.
Well, it was, I'm going back to 2002 now. I have to rejig my memory a bit. It was on university campus where I was the president and was president of a student union. And there were people who were being, who were drinking for, you know, since morning. And by the afternoon, they attacked quite a lot of Indians on the campus. In fact, 5-6 of them were hurt, myself included, and they threw beer bottles at us and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, university authorities were present there. It was in front of, in broad daylight, in front of about 500-600 people present that day. We reported to the police and they didn't take any action.
Okay. What has changed or accelerated in these recent attacks? How many attacks are we really talking about?
Well, we are talking on an average about one serious attack a day. Now, the problem in the last couple of years, what's happened, the two things have happened. Number one, in 2002, there were hardly, you know, a couple of thousand Indian students, but now we're talking about 100,000 Indian students in Australia. So from, and in Victoria, we were talking about 6,000, 7,000 students in 2000, and now we're talking about probably 50,000 students in Victoria. So there's like a 8 to 9-fold jump. And so the rate of incidents have increased, but so has the intensity of the violence. We used to be thrown with beer bottles, or there used to be verbal abuses or punch and stuff like that, but recently weapons have been used.
Now, before I go to kind of a big picture question about what the tolerance is in that society for racial diversity, the Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, has said any of these attacks are deplorable, but people have also criticized the idea of fighting back, that this is becoming some kind of a, you know, one group versus the other group vigilante situation. Do you consider yourself, your federation, in any way crossing the line in responding, and do you think the government is responding well?
Well, there are two things. Number one, if you put it in perspective, there's never been any reported vigilante attacks conducted by our group, number one. Number two, we have always called for calm and peace, and we have released media releases. We have been working with the police commissioner. We have helped police in all the investigations against any crime done by or against Indians. It doesn't matter. So I think that's an, and again, I think it's a more like a political spin that is trying to blame the victims again.
All right.
Again, the fact of the matter is that students don't have vote. Now, if they don't have vote, they are not part of a democratic process. The only way they can get their voice heard is by collective action, by demonstrations.
All right. So well, we're going to have to leave it there, Mr. Gupta. We will be keeping an eye on the racial tensions in Australia. We were speaking with Gautam Gupta, the head of the Federation of Indian Students Association in Australia.
Live from Melbourne.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We are talking today about suburban living. It's taken on several different lights through the years, negative and positive. We want to know what's your take on it. Yes, I like walking on a lawn, but I also like being able to roll out of bed and go to a coffee shop. Is suburban living a dream or a nightmare? Tell us your thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And now, Femi, take it away.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. In Washington, D.C., armed guards, metal detectors and X-ray machines are greeting visitors to the Holocaust Memorial Museum today. The museum is reopening 2 days after James von Brunn is accused of shooting a security guard to death. The former President George H.W. Bush is poised to celebrate his 85th birthday this weekend by making a parachute jump in Maine, but there is a chance of rain and that could dampen his plans. If the event is rained out, the former president will jump on Saturday. Election officials in Iran are extending voting time there today because of record turnout. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is facing three other candidates at the polls, and if nobody gets a majority, there will be a runoff, and full results aren't expected for a day or so. A leading anti-Taliban cleric is now dead in Pakistan, the apparent target of an assassination strike. Suicide bombers hit the mosque he was in during prayers today. Another suicide attack came at the same time at a mosque near a military building in the northwest. And the latest attacks come as Pakistan's army intensifies its assault on the Taliban in the country's unstable northwest region. The Middle East envoy, George Mitchell, is preparing to visit Syria. So far, on his latest trip, he has met with Israeli, Palestinian, Egyptian and Jordanian leaders. And that is a look at some of the top stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you so much, Femi. Well, we have been waiting for the train this week. Here it comes.
Hey, kid, out loud now so as I can hear what you're saying.
I'm checking the passages, getting on and off.
Uh-huh.
Front and back.
Yeah.
Shutting the doors. Rear section first, then the front section.
Those are sounds from the 1974 movie, The Taking of Pelham 123. And the same week that we here on the show are looking at American cities embracing rail, the latest blockbuster to hit movie screens today features The Train and a starring role. It's a remake of that film, which starred Walter Matthau in a New York City subway. And the new movie sounds more like this.
Control Center calling Pelham 123.
Rail Control Center, do you read me?
Who is this?
This is the man who is going to give this city a run for its money.
Woo! Now, if the old train sounds like a steel factory, the new one sounds more like a laptop.
In space.
Tony Scott is taking a look at both of them. He's a film critic for our partner, The New York Times. How are you?
Good. Great. Not to be confused with the Tony Scott who's the director of this film, the remake.
Ooh, spooky.
Not a conflict of interest.
Do you get checks redirected to your home address?
Unfortunately. But I like to say that around my house, he's known as the other Tony Scott, and around his house, I'm known as who?
All right. Well, speaking of who's starring in whose life, okay, is The Train better than John Travolta, who plays the bad guy?
Well, The Train is one of those impressive new kind of stainless steel and aluminum, very shiny talking trains with the digital display. It gets hijacked by John Travolta and his gang of thugs whose motives are murky for a while, just who this guy is and what he's doing and what he thinks he's going to get away with. I have to say he's pretty good. You know, he does his kind of overacting bad guy, chomping at the bit kind of thing. But it's a nice contrast, him and Denzel Washington, who is very sort of cool, playing what was the Walter Matthau part. In this case, an MTA. Walter Matthau was a transit cop. Denzel Washington, whose character is named Walter Garber in tribute to Walter Matthau, I think, is an MTA employee who's been demoted to dispatcher. So he's sitting in this big high-tech command center watching the trains on a digital display. And it does emphasize how much the subway system has changed in 35 years from this kind of rickety, falling apart, crumbling symbol of New York's decline
to this futuristic, crumbling, falling apart system of New York's decline.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, it's funny that you mention the way things have changed so profoundly because, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the original. I have not yet seen this new movie, but in the original, we see the character that Denzel plays in the remake, and this is Walter Matthau giving a tour to Japanese dignitaries.
New York City subway system is the largest in the world. 7,000 cars, 237 miles of track. Right over here, the status board pinpoints the disposition of every transit authority patrolman presently in the field. That's it. Get a good shot of that. Well, things are usually jumping pretty good in here.
Oh, man, those were the days, you know? It's just like we have this machine. And, you know, when you talk about not just the machine, but we've been talking, John, all week about cities.
Sure.
What does this remake say about New York as a city? Do we see echoes of a post 9/11 New York? How do they play that card?
I think we do. I mean, I think that it's an index of how the anxieties of the city have shifted. You know, in the 1970s, it was crime and street crime that was making people anxious, getting mugged on the subway. And now it's much more about, you know, being blown up by terrorists. And in fact, the assumption when this gang takes over the subway train is that they're terrorists. Are they terrorists? Are you terrorists? What do you want? There's an interesting twist when you find out who they were that I think also goes to a change in the identity of the city. Because one of the things that's most interesting about this movie, I think, I mean, it's a very straight-ahead sort of action thriller, but very well executed, and the other Tony Scott is a master at this kind of, you know, kinetic fast
OTS, cutting. Call him, yeah. Right.
But what's sort of interesting is that it does have some sly comments to make about not just post 9/11 New York, but the New York that's been dominated by Wall Street, money culture, hedge funds. And there's a sort of intimation of what comes after that and what the fallout or the consequences of that have been.
I'm just wondering, in pure movie terms, and maybe you share this or not, but is the taking of a subway car as a plot idea any less ridiculous in this movie than it was in the original? And I love the original, too.
No. Okay. And it's sort of the fun of it. It's like it's always been part of the movie itself. Both of the movies say, "What are these guys? What, the subway train? What are they going to do with the subway train?" So it's in a way,
or get away from taking over a train for a while. Remember, there was the teenage joyrider who took over a subway train.
Yes, who was obsessed with who was an aspiring motorman. Who was obsessed with it. But
I digress.
The sort of, you know, because the question in both cases is, how are these guys going to get away? It's a closed system. It's bounded on all sides. You can't, you know, take your subway to Cuba or Algeria.
You remember in Speed, Keanu Reeves had the whole subway pop out of terra firma, man. What you talking about?
Gotta make it to Westchester. That's all.
Exactly.
Coney Island.
Here's one thing that I noticed was that in the original, the demand was $1 million for all the hostages and the train.
Right.
Now in the remake, the demand is for $1 million per hostage.
Well,
that's inflation.
Its prorate is for $10 million. Which, and there's a reason for this, because the hijacker knows that this is the amount of money that the city can get its hands on and give to him. But there's a twist to that too, because $10 million. I mean, the inflation in 35 years isn't just tenfold; it's a lot more than that. It's sort of a bait and switch thing. The $10 million is the explicit demand, but actually he's got a scheme to make much, 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 much more. We're talking about what's $10 million in this age
in the Madoff world,
right?
Well, this is the kind of thing that we just love talking about, is the intersection of pop culture and reality. Do you think that this is escapism, reality, or both?
Well, I think it's both. I think the best movies always are. They take you to some completely imaginary, crazy place and situation, and then, but keep some contact with reality. So the best kind of Hollywood popcorn blockbuster movies for me are the ones that get you thinking a little bit as you leave the theater after being, wowed by the spectacle.
The sizzle, and it makes you think. Tony Scott, otherwise known as the Tony Scott, not the other Tony Scott, film critic for our partners, the New York Times. Thanks, Tony and John.
Talking about the remake of The Taking of Pelham 123. Pelham, is actually a suburb of New York. We're talking about reinventing the suburbs. What do you think of suburbs? Are they American dream-like or American nightmare-like?
I'm Mitch from Brooklyn. I grew up in suburbs, Rockland County, New York. And I would say it was great as a kid, but horrible as a teenager.
Your take at 877-8 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. Our podcast to go has everything on the show, like your takeaway.
These elections have exposed serious rifts within the ruling leadership, but they've also excited the public like no other election before.
The excitement of Afshin Malavi, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, talking about Iran's elections on The Takeaway. Voting taking place today. Results over the weekend.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Then was this.
Good evening. The U.S. Embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students. The Americans inside have been taken prisoner.
I recommend them to just vote based on their own views and decisions. And in this,
now is that. Almost exactly 30 years after the hostage crisis, Iran is exploding again, this time with democracy. A campaign for president ends, and the most important election since Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution begins. Democracy by the book. Is it the Quran, stupid? Real politics in the Islamic Republic on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, June 12th.
full coverage of the Iranian elections coming right up. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai today. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. Coming up this hour, we're going green, talking about green from our communities to China. Two conversations looking at the challenges of smart growth. Plus, we'll tell you what you need to know from an important new report on AIDS in Africa. All this and more ahead, but first we've got your latest headlines.
And in the headlines, election officials are extending voting time in Iran, citing record turnout. Hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's strongest challenger is the reform-minded Mir Hossein Mousavi. There's no exit polling, so full results aren't expected for a day or so. Four candidates total. If no one gets a majority, there will be a runoff. Free TV changes forever today. If you haven't got your converter or your digital TV or your cable subscription, you're going to be one of the millions of Americans who lose the ability to pick up free over-the-air analog signals today. It ends today. The FCC can help you with any problems you may be having.
The Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington reopens today. Wednesday's shooting there killed a museum guard and left the suspect critically wounded. James Von Brunn is charged with first-degree murder. And staying in Washington, a bill giving the Food and Drug Administration broad power over tobacco should be ready for the president to sign it. It cleared the Senate yesterday with a bipartisan support. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin says the FDA will be a tough watchdog.
That agency is going to be watching every move they make, the way they advertise, the way they market, what they put in their products, the warnings they put on their products, every step of the way.
Of course, the president can only sign it once the House passes it, which may well happen today.
Strong thunderstorms have Texas dealing with flooding, power outages, canceled flights, widespread damage. The storm system is pounding the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and the storm's not over yet. African court says Madonna can adopt a second child. The Malawi High Court ruled in her favor earlier today. Lady Madonna, children at her feet from Africa. Another chunk of General Motors is reportedly close to being sold. Not to Mr. Goodwrench. The Sweden-based Saab says a deal is close, but isn't naming the buyer. Swedish media reports the group buying Saab includes Koenigsegg, a small Swedish company known for million-dollar custom sports cars. An official announcement could come as early as today. LA Lakers have a 3-1 lead over the Orlando Magic, and the Stanley Cup will be decided tonight. Red Wings versus the Pittsburgh Penguins. Dow kicks off at 8770. S&P starts trading at 944. Flat opening predicted by the futures trading this morning. We're talking about the suburbs. If they're reinventing the suburbs in the urban planning world, what are your memories of growing up in the suburbs or your loathing of the suburbs from afar? Do you think they're a dream or a nightmare? Ways of living in America changing? We're talking about the suburbs. Give us your story at 877-8MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Record turnout today in Iran's most widely watched election, certainly in the last 30 years of Iranian history. We're used to watching demonstrations in Tehran and other events of a more religious, political nature, standoffs against the West, nuclear headlines. That's what we're familiar with. But an election inside Iran that's very much about Iranian issues and local politics, it's not what we're familiar with, but it's pretty exciting to watch. Here's a feel of what it sounds like to be in Iran today. It's the jingle from the main newscast of Iranian TV, Channel 1. The news coverage has been wall-to-wall, and Afshin Malavi has been listening to most of it. Afshin is the senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom. Afshin, tell us what you think about the media's coverage of this election, both inside and outside of Iran. What's it done to raise the profile of what's currently going on in Iran?
Well, John, I think the most important aspect of the media coverage of this election within Iran has been the fact that state television has hosted live televised debates for the very first time in the history of Iran's presidential election history. So what we had was a president, a sitting president, facing challengers, facing criticism. And when you have a population that is frustrated about the high levels of unemployment, underemployment, inflation, this was, you know, mesmerizing for them to see challengers calling the president a liar, questioning his statistics. The president counterpunched effectively, pointing to the corruption of the ruling elite. But so within Iran, state television is the medium that reaches most people. But there's also a very lively newspaper media. And interestingly, John, Iranians have taken to social networking sites, the internet. There's about 150,000 Iranian Facebook users. And SMS text messaging has also become a very important way to get messages across, particularly political messages.
And all those new media outlets definitely favor the youngest voters inside Iran. Joining us now is Apuria Jafareh, BBC Monitoring journalist who works for our partners, the BBC, at BBC Monitoring, which is actually literally looking at all of the coverage and all of the voices coming out of Iran this morning. Apuria, what are you hearing? We're already hearing that the turnout has been high, and we've talked to the voter this morning who described a very enthusiastic street scene throughout Tehran. What are you seeing and hearing?
Yeah, that's right. It's been massive, and there have been long queues at all polling stations, and I expect this is going to be a record turnout, even more than 12 years ago when President Khatami was elected.
And give me a sense of is the media playing this very, very straight? Is there a contrast between state media and television coverage and what you're seeing and hearing on blogs and Facebook and those kinds of sources?
Yes, the TV, based on the election laws, they're prohibited of any advertisements today. So they're just covering the story, they're covering the elections, they're covering the people coming out and voting. But it's going to be very important because both sides are asking the people to go and vote. Obviously, the system wants the Iranian government wants the more people voting for the Iranian government, it means they do believe in the system. And the reformists, on the other hand, who are challenging Mr. Ahmadinejad, they are asking their supporters to go and vote because the bigger the number of votes are, it's going to be more difficult for Mr. Ahmadinejad to hit that 50%.
Afshin, I do want to get you Puria, perhaps, you want to comment on this as well. What about the amount of power that Ahmadinejad has? Because he is not the sole arbiter of what happens in Iran. There's also a split leadership between the president and the religious leaders. How much power does the president now or the next president really have? I'll start with you, Afshin.
This is an important question, Farai. You know, the president of Iran is not the most powerful figure in Iran's political establishment. That is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is unelected by the people. So, in fact, if we're going to make a prediction about these elections, the prediction I will make is that after all the voting is said and done, the supreme leader will still be the most powerful man in Iran. He is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He is the key decision-maker on foreign and defense policies. Now, having said that, this does not mean the presidency is inconsequential. The president appoints cabinet ministers, appoints provincial governors, makes the budget and planning, and so the president does have a very significant role in Iranian politics. It's not the decisive role.
Well, Afshin Mallavi, thanks so much for helping us out this morning. A fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom. Apuria Jafareh at the BBC in London. Is there any scenario under which a turnout number in Iran would constitute even an implicit challenge to the religious authorities in that people are saying with their feet, we want more power?
It's very difficult to say. We had the experience of Mr. Khatami. Obviously, he had the support of people. But this time, it is a bit different because the three candidates who are challenging Mr. Ahmadinejad, their slogan is change. It's something like Barack Obama in States, you see. So that people are asking for change. And this time, the president... he doesn't have as much power as the supreme leader does, but this time he can use the support of people to make some changes in some key areas of the country.
So, Apuria, let's talk a little bit about the idea that this 50% number is a really important number. What is the chance that no one will get a 50% number and that we will be doing this all over again as a runoff?
Okay. The government numbers say that there are 46 million something people eligible to vote. So we expect, I expect, that there's going to be 80% turnout today, something like 80% turnout.
Wow.
Maybe
that's
more.
That's huge.
So that's a number around like 36 million, 37 million maybe. And Mr. Ahmadinejad or whoever wants to win the first round, they need to hit at least 18, 19 million, which is massive. They need a big support if we're going to have a president tomorrow.
All right, great stuff. Pouria Jaffre, BBC monitoring journalist, listening to the voices coming out of Iran from all over the country as Iranians go to the polls. Joining us now is Shapi Khorsandi. She's a stand-up comedian and author of A Beginner's Guide to Acting English. She's also, from a very different perspective, watching the political developments in Iran. She joins us from London. Shapi, I guess it's fair to say that if you lose Ahmadinejad as a character, it's going to be a real tragedy for you and comedians all over the Persian-speaking world, correct?
Well, thankfully, the Islamic Republic of Iran has many characters that are worthy of comedy material, so I don't think we'll run out of them in a long time. But I think that I am hopeful for this election. So, like one of your last speakers, Afshin, at the end of the day, when you have a supreme leader in a country, which sounds like some sort of comic book villain, it is difficult to really sort of be hopeful about the democracy in Iran. Having said that, the fact that so many people are wanting change now and turning out to vote, we can only keep our fingers crossed that there'll be somebody that will provide us with the characters that Ahmadinejad has in the past for the fuel of satire.
Laughs we need, I guess, would be the campaign slogan there. Shapi, what scenes of the campaign itself that you've observed have been either comical to you or moving and meaningful to you?
Well, I think it's very hard, in all seriousness, to think of anything comical about the plight of voters in Iran, particularly young people. I think I have cousins out in Iran who have been voting for the other guy. And I love that. I deliberately call him the other guy because we have somebody who a lot of people don't even know the major opponent to Ahmadinejad or didn't know him until now. Because on the one hand, they have a Holocaust denier and they have the other one who's not a Holocaust denier. So they're all going, yay, the other one out in the streets. And I really think, the hope is that that the young people, the vast, huge, enormous population of young people in Iran are able to feel hopeful that there will be a change in their government in the future to sort of give them the opportunities
right.
that I was lucky enough to have leaving Iran.
Shapi Khorsandi, just a very few seconds. Do you think this election is the most important democratic moment in Iran in 30 years?
Unfortunately, I think we have had moments like this before when we've had reformists get in. I think a much more important situation would be if people were able to change the system and actually have a proper democracy.
Nothing funny about that. We will see. Shapi Khorsandi, stand-up comedian and author of A Beginner's Guide to Acting English, is one of the people we've been speaking to this morning, watching the Iranian elections. Very traumatic, very exciting. People in the streets. Turnout is at a record. Thank you, Shapi.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've been talking with new urbanists all week about changing where Americans live, like the suburbs, which we've been focusing on today. Do you have fond memories of the suburbs, or do you think of them, like a lot of movies do, as a nightmare?
John Dartmouth, Mass. I grew up in a suburb outside of New York City. The one thing I liked was that I could find quiet spots in nature that you could call your own in the suburb. And that's always a fond memory of mine.
What do you like or dislike about the suburbs? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Farai?
Well, John, now we're going to go to Africa, Southern Africa specifically. There's a new AIDS report that says that the numbers of South Africans infected with HIV/AIDS has stabilized. That means plateaued. But is that a good thing? Is it true that the number of teens, for example, with HIV has decreased? This morning, we are joined by Dr. Ernest Darko. He's in Johannesburg. He's chairman of Broad Reach Healthcare, a group that works to create national health programs. And Dr. Darko was also one of the leading figures in Botswana's national antiretroviral treatment program, the most successful public sector HIV/AIDS treatment program in Africa. Dr. Darko, I want to start with this report that says that the number of people infected with HIV has, quote, stabilized at 10.9%. What does that mean?
Basically, it means that if you take a snapshot of the population, you know, let's say over the last few years, that snapshot in terms of the percentage of people who are infected has not changed significantly.
Yeah. So
hopefully what that means is that we are seeing a decrease in new infections such that those new infections are not keeping the prevalence growing higher and higher and higher.
So do you believe, first of all, that those numbers are accurate? That, you know, and by that I mean both the stabilization aspect of the number and the 10.9% number.
I do believe those numbers are accurate. For example, I think we've always said that there's 5-point-something million infected people in South Africa. If you apply the 10.9% to the current population of South Africa, it is 5-point-something million people who are infected. So that number we've always known, and it's not different. In terms of stabilizing, the work done by the HSRC is first-class, top-notch research, and they conducted an excellent survey, probably one of the best in class, I do believe that those results are accurate.
Now, one thing that this report does indicate is that HIV prevalence among young people is down, and do you get a sense of that in doing the work that you do? Why is it important to really track young people in this epidemic?
I do believe that the data that the rates in young people are going down, and my belief is more based on more anecdotal things, but it seems that youth are a little bit more responsive to messages. The slightly older age groups, for some reason, seem quite fixed in their behaviors and a little bit harder to reach. So if there's a group that would respond to messages in the same way that youth are quicker at adopting technologies, etc. Right now, my 3-year-old knows more about the DVD remote than I do. I think if there is change, it will come from that group. And by the way, it's critical that that group does reflect the change, because that's the group that is uninfected largely right now and then increasingly becomes infected as they grow older. So if we're going to break the back of the epidemic, we have to have the youth demonstrate that change.
Well, I'm wondering if, and again, you know, anecdotal information is hard to combine with broad statistical information, but are you seeing at the clinical level any signs of behavioral changes that could be significant?
Well, at the clinical level, we would not actually expect to see any change reflected, because keep in mind, right now in South Africa, if we estimate we have 5-point-something million infected people, we, out of that 5-point-something million, 1 million need treatment immediately, and currently we have maybe about 400,000-something on treatment. So that leaves, you know, close to almost 600,000 people who need treatment right away, and then another, you know, 4 million who would need to come through for treatment or care through the pipeline. So actually, we would like to see more people showing up at the hospital and at earlier points, because currently the problem we have is everybody comes when they're sort of on death's door expecting a miracle, and it makes it unsustainable.
Well, speaking of the resources, there was a controversial report that came out, it was really about a year ago. The report was from the Harvard Public Health School, and it said that 330,000 people died needlessly because Thabo Mbeki's government did not take responsibility for HIV and for bringing in enough medication. It was a very controversial report. Do you believe that it is true?
I cannot attest to the actual number because I didn't read the methodology behind the report and how they actually calculated that number. What I do believe, however, and I think we've seen it a number of times, in particular on the African continent, we've had many situations where certain policies that were put in place, whether in many cases even well-intentioned, I think have contributed to an increase in the overall suffering and death from HIV. And I think the stance taken by certain political leadership in this country definitely would have contributed to a delay in the response, and therefore I think a more death and suffering than otherwise if good leadership and proper sound action had been taken much earlier.
Doctor, we only have time for one quick final question. What is the most important thing? Is it funding? Is it awareness? What is the one thing to do to drop these numbers?
Behavior change. People have to change their behavior. HIV is 100% preventable. Nobody has to get infected starting tomorrow if that choice was truly made and internalized. And therefore, behavior change is absolutely critical, does not require an ounce more of funding if people really are able to change their behavior and take control of their own health and realize that they have a lot to do about whether they'll become infected or not.
That was some wisdom. Thank you so much. We were speaking with global health expert Dr. Ernest Darko. He's working with Botswana's National Antiretroviral Treatment Program, and Dr. Darko joined us from Johannesburg. Now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. There has been record turnout in Iran's presidential election today. Officials extended the polling time by 2 hours because of the heavy traffic. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is facing a strong challenge from the former prime minister. The election comes as the US is trying to push for a new policy of engagement with Tehran. Back in Washington, President Barack Obama meets at the White House today with the prime minister of Zimbabwe. Morgan Tsvangirai is in Washington to ask the US to give transitional support to the new unity government in Zimbabwe. Heavy security is the code of the day at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington as it reopens 2 days after a fatal shooting there. James Van Brunn has been charged with first-degree murder of a security guard. That's a look at some of the top stories making news this morning for I.
Thanks so much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hey, how's your commute going? For the last 50 years, the suburbs have been built up. They represent the greatest source of growth in the American economy. But are those communities going to be changing soon? All week long, we've been looking at communities around the United States that are going to have to change and that may potentially be changing for economic, environmental, or climate change reasons. James Howard Kunstler wrote a book called The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. You can imagine a conversation with him would include a lot of jokes and chuckles. Well, we spoke to Kunstler. Kunstler is one of the thinkers who's gathering in Denver, part of our series looking at new urbanists trying to reinvent and reimagine the future as it's happening in communities like Denver. And I said, if Kunstler would look down the road in the future, what are some suggestions for Americans looking and perhaps hoping for concrete, real ways to mobilize change?
The changes that we're faced with, we're going to have to make whether we really like it or not. The future is going to compel us to behave differently in the United States. The trouble is that we've We've overinvested in a certain infrastructure for daily life, namely suburbia, which has no future. And it's a very big problem for us in every way. It's a problem for us in terms of money, in terms of our psychology, in terms of, you know, what we're willing to do, how we're going to marshal the will to get it done.
But abolishing the suburbs, is that going to be politically
viable?
No,
we're not talking about abolishing the suburbs. We're talking about the need for Americans to deploy themselves on the landscape differently. Look, the suburbs have a certain destiny that is going to come to pass no matter what we do, whether we like it or not. It's not a matter of, you know, one of the strange ideologies that developed in the last 10 years or so is that suburbia is great because Americans like it. You know, that's what David Brooks at the New York Times says, and Bob Brueggemann at the University of Illinois, and it's just not true. You know, history has mandates of its own, and the new mandate that we face is to live differently in the United States. The living arrangement that Americans think of as normal is obsolete.
Well, speaking of mandates, the mayor of Denver, who we spoke with earlier this week, is trying to get light rail into the suburbs by marshaling some of the political will in both his city and in the outlying areas. And he wants to bring light rail, and he says it benefits people whether the stations come to their town or not. Listen to the mayor here, and I want your critique.
Our goal was to say, all right, if we get more people off their cars and into light rail, then the people that really benefit are those who are still driving in, but now, you know, get 20 or 30 extra minutes every day that they can spend either with their family or at work.
Reducing traffic jams by 20 to 30 extra minutes. Is that radical enough for you?
Well, he's obviously faced with a political problem of the existing investments that we've made in the car and all the infrastructure for it and having to navigate around it. Look, we have a railroad system at every level in this country that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. We have to do better. And if we don't, we're not going to be going anywhere.
So the doing better part, how do we responsibly marshal political will to make radical changes without just turning politics into a wait for the tsunami kind of vigil?
Well, for example, the Obama administration, and I voted for President Obama, the Obama administration has essentially just decided to talk about and think about rail rather than do something about rail. You know, the investments that they have laid out for rail are minuscule compared to the amount of new highways that they're going to build or want to build in the next few years, and it's just plain crazy.
Well, what would it be a practical pilot project of resettlement or redesign that would begin to demonstrate the viability of some of these kinds of things that you talk about?
I think the new urbanists have already demonstrated that over the last 15, 20 years with many of the projects they've done, including the urban infill projects to revive, reactivate, and re-inhabit our existing towns, which is really where we're heading.
And if I were an investor in this new urbanism future, would I be looking for properties and neighborhoods in center cities or in suburbs?
I think that what we're going to see with cities is going to be surprising to people. Our big, big metroplex cities, I think, are going to get in as much trouble as the suburbs. I think the action will be in our smaller cities and smaller towns.
So towns like Albany.
Places that are scaled appropriately to the energy diets of the future.
And one of those places would be?
Well, there are hundreds of them, you know, Dayton, Ohio, Troy, New York, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
I've lived in all those places.
The list is very long.
I must be a new urbanist. What is it about the scale of, say, Grand Rapids, Michigan that makes it ideal for trying some of these ideas?
Well, our largest cities have just attained a scale of operation that can't be carried on into the future. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with where these places are going to be located. There are some parts of the country are much more favorable than other parts. Obviously, the places like Las Vegas and Tucson and Phoenix, those places are going to get into even more trouble than, you know, than Atlanta and Baltimore and Philadelphia.
And because they're far away from natural resources and the cost of sustaining growth there is going to get higher and higher as the energy gets more and more expensive. James Howard Kunstler, new urbanist and the author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. He will be lecturing later on this week at the Congress of New Urbanism that we've been focusing on all week long in Denver, Colorado. James Kunstler, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
And you can check out our entire series on how the landscape of the American city and the suburbs are all changing in the 21st century on our website, thetakeaway.org. Special thanks to transportation writer and safarist Matt Dellinger, who went on his very own Denver exploration in order to report on the changes that are happening in that particular city. Waiting for Femi OK here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. The American exchange student Amanda Knox was in court today to testify for the first time in her sex murder trial in Italy. She is accused of taking part in the 2007 killing of her British housemate. Prosecutors say that the victim was murdered after refusing to join in an orgy at a party that then turned violent. A bill to give the Food and Drug Administration the power to regulate tobacco products is on the way to the president's desk. The Senate backed it yesterday. Senator Richard Durbin, in a news conference after the vote, says that the FDA will put the tobacco industry under a microscope.
That agency is going to be watching every move they make, the way they advertise, the way they market, what they put in their products, the warnings they put on their products, every step of the way.
Now, the president is expected to sign the bill, and the new law will reduce the number of young people who smoke by around about 11% over the next decade. South Koreans are bracing for a possible third nuclear test by North Korea. The Associated Press says that a counter-proliferation official says that it's likely to happen despite UN sanctions. And tough UN sanctions on Pyongyang might be approved as early as today. That's a look at stories making the headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
Welcome to Detroit.
In Detroit City, they're thinking about one thing today, and they've been thinking about it for weeks. It's the Stanley Cup, which ends tonight. The contest between the Detroit Red Wings and the Pittsburgh Penguins has been an exciting contest, but if you are lifelong fans of the Detroit Red Wings, this is a pivotal moment in what we can fairly say must be long and happy lives. Jason Dritzen and Michelle Rostelli join us from Detroit, Michigan. Guys, if you are lifelong Detroit Red Wings fans, you have had long and happy lives, correct?
Correct.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So what's on the line tonight, Jason?
Well, we'll be taking in the game downtown near the Joe Louis Arena, rooting on the Red Wings, and hoping they can give us something to cheer for throughout the summer.
Michelle Rostelli, are we going to see an octopus on the ice, do you think, tonight?
I would say probably most likely.
Can either of you explain to me this ritual of throwing an octopus onto the ice and... octopuses have not been hurt in the preparation of this story. I just want to say that right up front. Jason, Michelle, can anyone of you explain this?
Well, the story of the octopus heads back to the original 6 days when there were 6 teams in the NHL, Detroit Red Wings being one of the original members. To win the Stanley Cup back then, you had to win 8 playoff games to get Lord Stanley's Cup, and hence the 8 tentacles, and just became a representation throughout expansion of the NHL. You have to win more, 16 games now, but that tradition has long served here in the city of Detroit.
I like it, and I'm a fan of octopus. As an appetizer at an Italian restaurant. Michelle Rostelli, what do the Red Wings have to do to win tonight?
They had to play pretty well, aggressive, keep their defense up, but also have their forwards kind of in front of the net scoring the goals.
And Jason and Michelle, many have spoken about the Red Wings, and, you know, I'm talking to you from New York, where, of course, the Yankees are the huge franchise here, that, in fact, it's the Red Wings that are the most successful sports franchise in history. If you were to make that claim, Jason, what arguments would you use in your favor?
Well, I mean, it's funny. We're often, you know, referred to as the Yankees of the NHL, which, you know, isn't a bad thing. But I think, you know, the cups alone, the tradition, the icon that's on the winged wheel, it's highly recognized. And it's through, you go throughout the country, the Detroit Red Wings travel very well. You see many jerseys and sweaters dotted throughout other arenas.
You know, I can tell both of you have been watching these games because your voices are so raw. You guys have been screaming for how long now, Michelle?
Well, since the start. Who do they play first? Columbus?
Right, that's right, that's right. And that was an exciting series, too.
Yeah, it was good.
Finally, Michelle, how would you rate this series in the environment of all the bad news in Detroit? It's some pretty welcome good news, wouldn't you say? A couple seconds here.
Yeah, I think definitely it'll bring positive, you know, feelings, positive families, positive everything to the city, not only tonight but through the parade and everything, I think.
Well, Jason Dritzen and Michelle Rustelli, let's just say we've got a couple of takeaway fingers crossed for the Red Wings tonight. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Go Wings.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Happy Friday again. We have been asking you today for your take on suburban living. Is it a dream or a nightmare? Are you going to go barbecue in your backyard or sit out on your stoop? Anyway, here is a listener who moved from the suburbs back to New York City.
Yes, my name is Harry Tarzan. I lived in the suburbs of Annapolis for 15 years. Now I've moved back to a home that's over my store in Park Slope. The difference is amazing. I'm an older person, and in the suburbs, I spend a lot of my time planning around my car, and the urban setting is much more convenient for me as an older person. I can get around New York on a dollar.
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And I have heard that, you know, many times from many people that, you know what, if there's a bus going by, it makes it so much easier to grow old gracefully and enjoy your life. Femi OK Now has the headlines.
And Femi OK gave you a little preview of Femi OK's voice a little earlier.
But once more for the week, Femi. You got a chance to close it out in a positive note.
Just never enough time on the air. Yeah. I just love it so much. Okay, good morning, everybody. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington reopens today. Wednesday's shooting there killed a museum guard and left the suspect critically wounded. James von Brunn is charged with first-degree murder. Free television changes forever today. More than a million Americans lose the ability to pick up free over-the-air stations today.
What moron?
1 million people, okay?
They know already.
Are you calling?
They figured it out.
1 million people,
it's
morons?
Done. Who cares?
Shame on you.
It's like they raise off. What am I going to do? Sorry.
It is the last day for analog broadcast signals. Basically,
thanks
that means
reminding
that
me of that.
If you don't have a cable subscription, and around about 1 million people don't, or a new digital TV, you will now need a special converter box to watch your local stations. And
them converter boxes come from the CIA.
Would you like to do the news for me?
No, I'm just adding a little detail.
Right. Doing a story about
I'm sitting quietly.
Yeah. you're responsible. You know, you're actually a responsible journalist.
Oh, TGI Friday. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, and her daughters Sasha and Malia are back in the White House today. No prizes for guessing where they went to. They came back from a vacation in Europe.
They were touring with the Clash.
Following the President's visit to Europe and the Middle East last week, they stayed on and they had a great time. After Paris, the Obama family went to London. They went on the Harry Potter set. They went to see The Lion King. stopped at sites like Big Ben, Westminster Abbey, Tower of London. They even had good old fish and chips. And I mean fish and big steak fries.
And changed their names to...
What, you want them to give them a British
big
name?
Big Audio Dynamite or something like that. Yeah, like,
okay. All right, okay. Everybody, I try to do the news for you. I'm over and out. Enjoy your weekend.
Heck of a job. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome. Thanks, Femi.
And we are grateful to close out the show by welcoming David Sandilow, the Assistant Secretary of Energy. He joins us from Washington, and he's just back from a meeting of top-level officials from the U.S. and China. The meeting took place in Beijing. Mr. Assistant Secretary, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Let's, first of all, describe the significance of these talks. The two biggest carbon emitters, it's probably fair to say, maybe there's someone else in there that might make the top three, but China and the U.S. talking about climate change. What's the argument here?
Well, I tell you, they were good talks. Things have changed so much. I first visited China in 1981. I was a student on one of the early foreign exchange programs between our two countries way back then. In that summer, there was one international phone line in the entire city of Shanghai that I could use to call home in this vast city. Now, when I arrived in Beijing last week, my BlackBerry automatically connected to a wireless network within moments of my plane arriving in Beijing. And by the time we got to the terminal, I had already sent messages back home, and I had called. By the time we were in the airport, I was using my cell phone to call D.C. You know, I guess when I think about that contrast between 1981 and today, it gives me a lot of hope for this global warming problem, which is so challenging, because I think that the United States and China are going to make big changes over the course of the next couple of decades and change our energy systems if we work together.
But isn't that very growth what leads officials in the U.S. government to believe that China alone and its massive economy could actually tip the scales on climate change regardless of what the rest of the world does?
Well, it could. China's economy is huge and growing, and if it uses 20th century technologies to grow during the 21st century, it's going to be a problem for all of us in terms of global warming. And so that's why we need to work together to get clean technologies out there, both in the United States and China. And by the way, what you said at the top was exactly right. Our two countries are the biggest greenhouse gas emitters in the world. Together, we're 45% of the world's global warming pollution. And all by right. the way, we're also the two biggest oil users and oil importers in the world. So We have some common interests, the United States and China. Neither one of us want to be reliant on imports from the Middle East for oil, for example.
All right. So if I'm a citizen of Poland or Belize and I'm looking at the two biggest carbon emitters and oil users talking about how they're going to fix climate change, how is that not some sort of conspiracy? Shouldn't you two be talking with me?
Oh, well, we are. These discussions on global warming are global and involve every country. But they also involve, pairs like the United States and China. I mean, the solution to global warming involves everybody, but it kind of just makes sense that when you've got two countries that represent the 45% of the total emissions, they ought to be talking to each other bilaterally, as the diplomats say.
All right. Well, then if China, which has vowed to get one-fifth of its energy from sustainable sources, actually achieves that, and of course there's some question about that, what would the U.S. do to demonstrate its willingness to make sacrifices?
Well, first, I think this whole agenda in both of our countries is about creating jobs. This is the economic future in the 21st century. It's clean energy. You know, today there are more jobs in wind energy in the United States than there are in coal mining. Jobs in all these fields are important, but there's huge growth going on in the whole clean energy area. It's one of the ways to get us out of our recession, both here in the United States and in China. What the Obama administration has done from the start is invest in this whole clean energy area. The economic stimulus bill that President Obama signed in February is the largest energy bill ever passed in the United States, with record-breaking investments in clean energy. There's a lot of exciting pieces of it. One of the pieces that excites me the most is on energy efficiency, because we waste so much energy in this country. And with some basic, simple investments, we can reduce the amount of energy we waste. And there's money in the stimulus package, for example, for investing in weatherizing low-income homes so less energy is wasted, and improving the efficiency of federal buildings. And that's the type of thing which creates jobs today, but then beyond that, it reduces bills forever. So
let me jump in here just for a second. One of the things that really strikes me is that when we talk about China, we are talking about leverage. China is a nation which owns much of the U.S. debt. Sometimes we are working in concert, and sometimes we are working at cross purposes as nations. How does America's financial relationship to China and diplomatic relationship to China affect our ability to work as partners on climate change? Is that even realistic?
Fry, that is an excellent question. I think that our two countries are deeply interlinked in many, many ways. The financial system is one that you just pointed to. The atmosphere is another. And so we have to find ways to be partners, even as we are competitors in some economic arenas. And so I think that actually this whole clean energy agenda can be a real pillar for cooperation between our two countries. We have such common interests. Both of our countries want to reduce our dependence on oil. And by the way...
But can the U.S. Have any authority, for example, to muscle China in any way? Or is that simply not possible?
I think it's a combination of pushing and pulling. I think, we have some very common interests with China, and both of us would benefit greatly. For example, if we could get electric vehicles out on the roads, which reduce our dependence on oil. And, we've just started to do that in the United States. General Motors has this car called the Volt, which is going to be a plug-in car. It's supposed to be coming out soon.
Understood.
On the road. China's starting to get out ahead of us on this. And so, there's some economic competition here, but there's also some cooperation our two countries can engage in.
David Sandilow is the Assistant Secretary of Energy, just back from Beijing. He joined us from Washington. Secretary Sandilow, thank you so much.
Well, we have been talking today about the American suburbs. Want to know your take, dream or nightmare? Bob writes to us, I grew up in the Detroit suburbs as a kid, and it was a wonderful situation, mainly because of having parks so close. It always gave us something to do. But he goes on to say that after living in New York City, going back to his hometown reminded him of one particular song lyric.
They roll back the sidewalks precisely at 10, and people who live there are not seen again.
That was John Denver talking about Saturday nights in Toledo, Ohio. And we've heard from a bunch of suburb haters or tolerators today. Let's hear from a lover.
This is Dan from the suburbs, Westchester. Born and raised in Manhattan, moved out about 10 years ago, and I love the suburb. I feel like a gentleman farmer.
Take All right. that to your weekend.
Exactly. We are going out in style.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.